Be acceptable in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Generally speaking, the Psalms have not provided inspiration to artists. The gospel stories have, but the Psalms simply haven't. Take a walk through the Metropolitan Museum and you will see the story of Jesus's life in magnificent paintings by Giotto and Michelangelo and Rembrandt and Tintoretto and Da Vinci and many, many more. There is one psalm, however, that though it did not move the great masters, has inspired regular folk artists throughout the ages. Many small little booklets have been produced with green watercolors of the 23rd Psalm. Maybe you had one when you were young. Our daughter Eliza was given one when she was 5, and she cherished it and called it my book of the 23rd Possum. On the cover of these books is usually a small child walking through a green valley with lush trees and delicate tiny flowers. The landscape is beautiful, but there is this big cloud in the sky moving ominously towards the child, casting a long shadow, which rocket scientists that we know is the shadow of death. I've never liked these paintings because they make depressing what is usually such a consoling psalm. Instead of feeling peace wash over us and wash over our sorrow, what is depicted really is the looming darkness, the inevitable approach of death. In the paintings, the beauty is a given. The beauty is our status quo. The valley is lush and verdant. The birds are flying. The flowers are blooming. And the foolish, naive little child is about to be cast in the dark. The message seems to be that sorrow will swallow up goodness. My sense is, however, that they have it backwards. The landscape of our lives can be dark. Can already be dark. We live in a world that is broken and disjointed, and there are times in all of our lives when the shadow of human darkness does seem to obliterate the light. Even fortunate people who have not been touched by deep sorrow or tragedy suspect that it is just a matter of time. All they need to do is look around them and know that their number could come up at any minute. But the promise of God and of this psalm is that the darkness can always be pierced by the light of God, that it is the light that is coming, not the darkness. So we come slowly and reluctantly to know that all is not right with the world. We are pulled to this reality as playful dragons roped and captured are dragged to the castle on the hill. It happens in fits and starts. It happens to some early in life and to others later. But it dawns on all of us eventually that something is wrong. I'd like to share just a few seemingly small examples from my life when I felt the shadow looming. I happened to wake up one night when I was young and wander into the living room of our apartment in New York City where a party was going on. My parents lived at the edge of the show business world when my father did a TV program called Omnibus. Among other topics, the program focused on the arts, and because of that, some of the celebrities who were on the show became good friends. They can be, as you might suspect, a fairly rowdy lot. No wonder I couldn't sleep. So when I walked into the living room, Sam Robards, Jason Robards, and Lauren Bacall's 3-year-old son was smoking a cigarette, and everyone was laughing at him and telling him how cute he was. And I knew something was wrong. The school I attended in New York City, as did Jim Hyde, was a pretty liberal place. It accepted the children that the prestigious upper crust schools would not. And in the 1950s and 60s, those were children of divorce and mostly children who were Jewish. I was one of two non-Jewish children in my class. As I've mentioned before, feeling so different and somewhat ostracized, I felt the sting of prejudice, and I used to lie and say that my grandfather on my mother's side was Jewish, because I knew enough about cultural identity in Judaism to know that the lineage is gone through the mother. Naturally, all of my best friends were Jewish, but there was something odd about their families. They had hardly any relatives, and they were so overprotective. My parents, on the other hand, pretty much let me come and go. But my friend's parents wanted to know where they were all the time, as if someone might come and snatch them in the night. And when I asked my friends where their grandparents were, a cloud passed over them and they looked down. Dead, they said, and many of their aunts and their uncles too. And from the way they said it and from what I knew of the Holocaust, I knew something was wrong. Once when I was walking home from school, a man came up to me and asked me if I was a model. And feeling greasy and pimply and fat, I was so flattered and so hopeful that I went into the dark entry of the brownstone building with him. And when he started touching me, my stomach seized and I bolted through the door, and I knew something was wrong. Reading this week of Asifa Bano, an 8-year-old Muslim little girl who was gang raped and murdered by Hindus in Kathua, India, I knew something was wrong. The abuse perpetrated on young girls by Larry Nassar, the former US Olympic gymnastics coach, makes us all know that something is wrong. As we learn more about the intricacies and the complexity of the current crisis in opioid abuse and dependency, what unsettles me is our tendency to cast shame on those so afflicted. Because shame dismisses, it does not heal. And when we turn away, we know that something is wrong and that we are part of what is wrong. We know that something is wrong. You have in your memory banks flickers of time when you smelled the stench of things gone wrong. The examples I've given point not to the random tragedy and heartbreaks that sweep us all from time to time, but from the disconcerting intentionality of evil. All of our lives are touched sooner or later by loss and sorrow, and some by the insidious piercing of intentional pain. We know we live under this possibility, under the shadow of the cloud as we walk through the valley of the shadow of death. The 23rd Psalm does not hide from this reality, but says, even though we know this is true, even though we know the world is a broken place and that the evil may lurk in a dark vestibule, we will fear no evil because God is our salvation. This is a startling statement to make. How can that be? And yet, how tenaciously we cling to that hope. Part of the great message of the psalm is that even though there seems an intentionality to evil, the intentionality of goodness and mercy and the intentionality of God are stronger and will overcome the darkness. Years ago, I raised a lot of animals, among them chickens, and the hens were my favorites, though not, I might add, the rooster. I named three of the hens Shirley, Goodness, and Mercy, because they followed me wherever I went. Roger Lovett, a pastor and author, has a great take on goodness and mercy. He sees them as angels, one named Goodness and the other named Mercy. But what gives these angels breath is a small mistranslation in the psalm itself. When it says, "Goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life," "follow" is an inaccurate translation. The correct translation of "follow" does not convey the translation to "follow" does not convey the force and urgency of the Hebrew word radpa, which means pursue. What a difference that makes. As with my hens, these angels, surely goodness and mercy, aren't just tagging along behind you. They aren't breathing your dust and yawning. They are after you. And if you duck behind a bush or wander down an alley that will bring you nothing but pain and heartbreak, they have a bead on your whereabouts and they will find you. Some of you may know the children's book by Margaret Weiss Brown called The Runaway Bunny. It's a story of a bunny and his mother and begins like this. Once there was a little bunny who wanted to run away, and so he said to his mother, "I am running away." "If you run away," said his mother, "I will run after you, for you are my little bunny." The bunny thinks of all sorts of places to go and things to be. He thinks he might be a fish in a trout stream and swim away from his mother, and she says that if he does that, she will become a fisherman and fish for him. He will become a rock, then she a mountain climber. He a crocus, she a gardener. He a bird, then she will be the tree that he comes home to. He a sailboat, she the wind. Finally, he a little boy, and she the mother who catches him in her arms and hugs him. Sensing the futility of this escape, "Shucks," says the little bunny, "I might just as well stay where I am and be your little bunny." Mercy and goodness are like that mother. Searching, rescuing, reassuring, embracing. Interestingly enough, the root of the word mercy is womb. Realizing this, it is no wonder that we speak of the motherhood of God. God will always seek us out, though we may choose to ignore her and go on hiding in the streams of ambition and greed, or sailing on the turbulent sea of anger and revenge. Wherever we go, these two angels from God will surely pursue us with the intent of bringing us home in one way or another to our God. So it is with the shepherd who leaves the grazing flock on the hillside to go out in search of one lamb who has wandered off. Jesus calls himself the Good Shepherd. He is the one who pursues us as well, the one who gives body to mercy and goodness. "The Lord is my shepherd," we hear, and we are instantly comforted. To explain himself, Jesus uses the metaphor of a shepherd, a simple person who cares for the wandering, stupid creatures who are inclined to eat poisonous plants and fall prey to wolves in the night. It sounds nurturing enough, but it isn't always so. To be pursued by Jesus can be frightening. The same is true of mercy and goodness, for they aren't always as pleasant as they sound. To be sought out by mercy is to be hunted by a hungry and demanding creature. Mercy does not only console, but its vital living nature asks that we reflect that mercy. When goodness and mercy have us, then how shall we act? Will we feel compelled to take more active voice in matters of social justice? Will we be driven to speak out against oppression and risk our jobs or our reputation? Will we intentionally consume less, strive for zero waste, love the planet, and forgive more? Will we go out in search of ways to help people rather than waiting to be asked? Will we comfort those who weep and pray for those who mourn? Spring is the season of God's mercy, reluctant though this one has been. Do you not feel that shortly you will be pursued at this time of year, It's hard to ignore the goodness calling us back from wherever we have wandered, calling us from bitterness to joy, from sorrow to thanks, from worry to hope, from revenge to forgiveness. The birds don't let us get a chirp in edgewise. The gravel on the lawn begs to be raked. Fallen branches and limbs lie evidence to winter's war. The rejuvenation of the earth is pursuing us this sunny earth day, calling us to action, calling us to care. And even if your days are quiet and life is peaceful, T.S. Eliot knew that in spring our hearts can be restless as memory is mixed with desire and dull roots are stirred with spring rain. So after a long winter, spring comes with intention to pursue us, to find us, to waken our hearts to God, to bring us home to a table that is prepared before us, to anoint our heads with oil, to fill our cups to overflowing, to remind us that surely goodness and mercy will pursue us all the days of our lives, and we will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Grace and peace.